Hello, this is Rick. This week's podcast was recorded before the tragic news of the passing of Niki Lauda. I met Niki a couple of times when I first worked in Formula One in the early noughties. He was running, or was the team principal, of the Jaguar Formula One team. Can't say I knew him, but he was always a larger-than-life figure around the paddock. Sadly, he's passed away at the age of 70 and obviously had that incredibly devastating crash in 1976. And since then has gone on to just tackle life with determination, being a non-executive chairman to the Mercedes team, building up his own airline, and all of the amazing things he's accomplished. One thing I can tell you about Niki, again, not really having ever been introduced to him, but he was a straight-talking guy who was right down the line, and when the cameras were off, he swore like an absolute trooper. Rest in peace, Niki Lauda. Never can you use the word legend enough about a man like him.
It's lights out and away we go.
Scott and Rick.
I don't really have a lot to comment on that.
Danny and Sunday have crashed. They've got into each other.
I wasn't listening. No idea what you're speaking about.
This is the F1 Podcast. Two soft compounds.
And welcome to episode number 11, Monaco Magic. I am Scott.
I'm Rick.
And we are the two soft compounds. We're going to be catching up later on, of course, with all the stats for the preview in the Monaco Grand Prix from our friend Niki at Lights Out. You can follow him on Twitter, of course, and we'll get all his stats later on. But this is one of my favourite races of the year in terms of spectacle and an excitement and build-up, I suppose. Have you calmed down, by the way, after last week?
After my ranting about Ferrari.
Yeah. Did you have a nice warm bath?
Yeah. Well, it was a cold bath. Yes, I've calmed down well enough to preview Monaco and still have a quick dig towards the end.
But it is like we just said, it's one of the best races in terms of spectacle, isn't it? You got the yachts, you got the superstars, you got the movie stars. The grid's amazing because it's so small, that bit. And I have been to Monaco once and they still had the Monaco grid, or I guess you'd call it track, set up because they were doing, they do like a month's worth of races, don't they? They do some classic car racing and, you know, so they kind of, it takes so long to kind of put it all together. I think they put it together and leave it up for a month. And like you say, they have loads of different races, you know, the classic car racing, the F1. I think they have some F2 and all sorts of stuff going on there, don't they? I was lucky enough to be there when I don't think the F1 race had happened yet, but they were ready for it. And the atmosphere is incredible. It's such a tiny little place, isn't it? And you can kind of wander around. I always remember a funny story as well, where my dad, who's not a Formula One fan, was on a business meeting once and he got put in a hotel and he had a balcony that overlooked the track. And he actually went downstairs and said, sorry, there's a bit of motor racing going on and I can't sleep very well. And the guy was like, sir, I beg your pardon? People pay millions of dollars to have this room and this balcony over the track. And my dad's like, yeah, but I'm struggling to sleep.
Ask him to keep it down, please.
I think it was like €10,000 a night on race weekends. My dad wasn't happy about that. But it's a magical weekend, Monaco.
Yeah, it's the week after the Cannes Film Festival, so everyone hangs around and runs the film festival straight into the Monaco Grand Prix weekends. There's always a lot of movie stars and glitz and glamour around. It's a fantastic track. You know, it's narrow because it's been in virtually the same configuration since the 1950s. Difficult to overtake on. So we can have processional races here, which is really the last thing Formula One needs after Barcelona. However, there has been lots of drama at Monaco. We often see it in practice and qualifying where people test the limits and push it a little too far and brush the wall. So let's hope for a good race. And as I mentioned in last week's podcast, this event brings back loads of memories for me.
There was a race, I think it was in the 1980s. I can't remember exactly what race it was, but there was literally a car broke down or crashed one lap after another. And I think we had about 7 or 8 race leaders changing literally lap by lap by lap with different leader. And you had some big, big names that were coming out of that race. And it's almost like that's the kind of thing we need from this Monaco Grand Prix, isn't it? Like, you know, not accidents and people hurting themselves, but we need, you know, engine breakdowns or something happening, bit of oil on the track, so a few people sliding around, and just some, you know, just some drama to happen so we can get some position changes and that sort of stuff. I do feel, I said this last week on the podcast, I do feel like there's going to be some sort of drama on this Grand Prix, and I feel like we're going to, because we went into Baku expecting an amazing race and it was very boring. I feel like this is the other way around. We're going into Monaco expecting it to be boring, but potentially could be very exciting.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. I think the Monaco race you're referring to is 96, where it rained. Olivia Panis run the race.
You're right. Was in the 90s. I thought it was the 80s.
No, I think it was. I think it was 96. Olivia Panis won the race in the Prost.
Yes, right, yeah.
Three race finishers that year. Mm. A quick fact fans, that race was when Coulthard was driving for McLaren, which was sponsored by Marlborough, same sponsors as Ferrari. And his helmet wouldn't stop misting up. So he went down to Michael Schumacher and said, can I borrow your spare helmet? And Schumacher said, yeah, because it had Marlborough around the top. So in that race, if you ever watch it on YouTube or anything, you can see Coulthard is wearing a Schumacher helmet whilst he's driving around. But an amazing race, loads of drama. That is desperately what we need this weekend.
Leaving screeching skid marks all over the place. Two Soft Compounds.
So Monaco was very special for me. When I worked in Formula One, I always try and remember this correctly. I worked in Formula One on the media side for 1.5 seasons. And the first race I worked on was the 2001 Monaco Grand Prix. And my job was to look after Jordan's sponsors.
Is this story, by the way, telling us why you only did half a season?
Oh, no, it's just the way it came about.
I was going to say, what happened there?
Oh, no, I did. Monaco was my first. I did the whole of the 2001 season, the whole of the 2002 season. And then everything changed because Jordan didn't renew with MasterCard. And so I was basically, my job was to look after the MasterCard VIPs, of which there were many at every race. So it was in the paddock club, introducing the drivers, interviewing the drivers whilst they were having their 6-course meal. Not the drivers, the VIPs. Interviewing Eddie Jordan on stage, doing the pit lane walkabout and showing them the pits, the Jordan pits and all that sort of stuff. However, at the 2001 race, I was kind of working, I was working for Jordan and MasterCard, but I was also doing a bit on the side for the Jaguar team, which was their client was Beck's Beer, which suited me perfectly because, you know, and this is, you know, straight up my street. So basically, halfway through that race, I had to get changed into my Jaguar team shirt and go and look after some of the Beck's VIPs. But this was brilliant because I don't know if you remember the 2001 race. Coulthard put it on pole, but then stalled on the parade lap. So he had to go right to the back of the grid. He had to start from the pit lane. And it was Eddie Irvine driving the Jaguar that came third. So the party going off at Jaguar was their first podium. It was unbelievable. And there I was with a paddock pass and a Jaguar team shirt on. So we partied well into the night. But it was just being a Formula One fan and getting the chance to work in Formula One, seeing all that glitz and glamour that goes with Monaco, God, that was special.
And this is back in the V10 days as well, isn't it? Oh. Those engines. I saw a clip the other day of some of the different racing cars going past, and it had the current engine that went past, followed by a V10. And it's just, you know, that for me is really lacking. I know the world's changing and we're going more green, and they need, you know, these better engines, and they're trying to bring on smaller engines for road cars and get the technology going. But those V10s just were so special, you know, it was like, it was like the noise was just unbelievable.
And in Monaco, because of the narrow streets and the tall buildings, if you weren't wearing earplugs in that race, you'd have your ears would be ringing for days afterwards. So everyone was wearing earplugs, whether you were in the hospitality or whether you were next to the track. It was loud, which is something that I really miss about Formula One.
Two Soft Compounds facial hair update.
Well, as you saw in Barcelona, the facial hair once again come up trumps for Bottas. The Bottas beard of speed, it put him on pole once again. And there is something about that stubble and that facial hair that's really changed him as a person. I do think there's more to it than that, but it does appear.
Let's hope so. Yeah,
it does appear that he's just grown a beard and gone, I've found all this speed all of a sudden. This is amazing. And Hamilton's like, what's happened here? My beard doesn't do this. But yeah, he's done another one. So let's hope that, let's hope that he's still got the beard of speed for the Monaco Grand Prix. And let's hope it does magic and wonders for him again.
Well, as we know, in Monaco, qualifying is probably the most crucial hour of the entire season in terms of qualification. Where you start in a Monaco Grand Prix can define your entire race. I think Max Verstappen in the Red Bull is going to have a strong weekend. We know that power isn't the big problem at Monaco. It's chassis and downforce. And Max has driven the wheels off that thing so far this season. You know, we talk about Gasly being a bit weak, but, you know, maybe Gasly's not. And maybe he's up there and Max is just pushing boundaries left, right and centre this year. I don't know. But I fancy Max to do well here. If you remember last year, he put it in the wall in qualifying, and something similar the year before, if I'm right. So always has a fairly strong showing, or Red Bull certainly have a strong showing in this race. Danny Ric has won here a couple of times, and it would be nice if they could pull something out of the bag.
And speaking of Danny Ric, the Renault team really do need a good race as well. And again, like you said, due to the fact that it's not really a power circuit, it does open things up a little bit, doesn't it? It gives other teams a chance. If you've got a good aero package, you stand a good chance at Monaco. But the likes of, you know, McLaren, and obviously Williams need a great race everywhere they go, but McLaren, Renault, you know, the Haas team, you know, all these teams need to do something a little bit special. And, you know, there's so many points. I think Renault are down to like eighth in the championship now, which is, you know, last year they finished fourth, I think, didn't they? So it's, you know, that's a huge drop already. So they need to get their stuff together. They need to work out what the problems are. They need to get on top of it all and, you know, make that car move forward. Like you've said, you know, the Ferrari seems to be going backwards at this point. You know, in Barcelona, it went backwards in speed as well as, you know, in the races. And the Mercedes is just moving forward. It's just going to get worse. The Mercedes is just going to stretch its leg and move further away. So all these other teams really do need to pull their fingers out. And I've got a funny feeling Monaco is going to just produce something that we're all like, wow, that was great.
Well, I think just because of the event itself, if we have a procession at Monaco like we had in Barcelona, it will still be more exciting Monaco simply because of the track, the danger, the walls. Also, strategy plays a massive part in Monaco. Now, Ferrari mucked that up again, and their season definitely is over. But strategy in Monaco is so important. Getting your car out into a clear slot and not in traffic. Managing the tyres is important. Staying away from the walls. And the other thing that I'm looking forward to is the young guns at Monaco. Notoriously difficult to overtake at, but these youngsters, Albon and Norris, they, I think, and Kvyat, they are the sort that will take a risk and be brave and get an overtaking manoeuvre done as they come out of the tunnel, which is the preferred place in Monaco, but will try it on all round the circuit, and I really quite like that prospect.
Check out twosoftcompounds.com for the latest news, competitions and updates.
Right, let's get a preview of the Monaco Grand Prix in terms of stats with our legendary stats man. It's Nicky. You can follow him on Twitter. It's @lightsout. And here he is with all the Monaco stats.
It's time for one of the most famous races of the year as Formula One heads to the playground of the rich and the famous for round 6 of the 2019 season. This will be the 77th running of the Monaco Grand Prix since the event was first held in 1929, and the 66th time it's been held as a round of the F1 Championship. The second lap of the race will be the 5,300th racing lap of the track since F1 first visited back in 1950. Mercedes head to Monaco having not failed to finish with both cars in the top two podium positions so far this season. If they do so this weekend, this will be the first time in history that a team have finished 1-2 in 6 consecutive races. Meanwhile, in qualifying, a 1-2 result would see Mercedes surpass McLaren's tally of front row lockouts, having equaled their tally last time out in Spain. Monaco is renowned for giving processional races, so it might be surprising to hear that from the 65 F1 races held here, the pole sitter has only won 29 times, giving a pole to win conversion rate of under 50%. Daniel Ricciardo's win last season marked the first time since 2014 that the pole sitter has won the race, though the pole man has finished on the podium in every season since 2004. The last time the pole sitter retired in Monaco was in 2002, when Juan Pablo Montoya was forced out of the race with engine troubles. The furthest back win here came in 1996 when Olivier Panis took victory from 14th on the grid. His is the only Monaco victory in the last 33 years to have come from further back on the grid than third. It's been a disappointing start to 2019 for Ferrari, but Charles Leclerc will be hoping to turn that around this weekend in front of his home crowd. The only time a Monegasque driver has scored a podium at home was in 1950, when Louis Chiron finished third for Maserati. Until Leclerc's third place in Bahrain this year, that was the only time a driver from the Principality had finished on the podium in Formula One. On Saturday, if Ferrari take pole, it'll be their 11th at the track, equaling McLaren's record tally of Monaco pole positions. This weekend marks the 300th Grand Prix entered by Kimi Raikkonen, though it will only be his 298th start. Should Raikkonen and Lewis Hamilton finish the race this weekend, they'll each equal Rubens Barrichello's record of 13 finishes at the Monaco Grand Prix. Carlos Sainz is the only driver on the 2019 grid to have a 100% point scoring record in Monaco. He's finished on all four appearances, with a best result of 6th in 2017. He's also reached Q3 on every appearance, and has out-qualified his teammate on all four visits. With Lando Norris, Alex Albon, Antonio Giovinazzi and George Russell joining the grid for 2019, the number of drivers to have competed in a Monaco Grand Prix weekend as a round of the F1 Championship will surpass 400 this weekend, though only 321 of those drivers have actually started a race here. There's an unusual statistic shared by Jean-Pierre Beltoir and Jochen Rindt at the Monaco Grand Prix. Both drivers only finished the Grand Prix once in their careers, and on both occasions Beltoir and Rindt took victory. Beltoir entered 8 Monaco Grand Prix between 1967 and 1974, failing to qualify on his first attempt, and then failing to finish the race in every year after that except 1972, where he won. Similarly, Rindt entered the race 5 times, but his only finish was on his final appearance in 1970, where he took victory. There are a number of drivers who are remembered as legends at Monaco, including Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost. For 10 seasons between 1984 and 1993, Prost and Senna were the only two drivers to win the Monaco Grand Prix. During that time, McLaren won 9 of the 10 races, with Senna's 1987 Lotus victory being the only non-McLaren win. Nigel Mansell was the only driver other than Prost and Senna to take pole during that 10-year period. Meanwhile, the original Mr. Monaco, Graham Hill, remains in the list of the top 10 all-time highest point scorers in the Principality. No driver has scored more points in Monaco than Sebastian Vettel, who has taken 150 points at the track so far in his career. Lewis Hamilton trails him on 137. Senna and Hill are the only drivers to remain in the top 10 points finishers here to have not raced in Monaco under the newest point scoring system, where 25 points are on offer for the win. Finally, if he completes 63 laps of the Monaco Grand Prix, Max Verstappen will surpass his father's total of laps completed in his F1 career. Jos Verstappen completed 4,497 laps over his 107 race career. Max has completed 4,435 laps in the 86 Grand Prix which he's raced in so far.
Two soft compounds.
So, looking ahead to this weekend's Monaco Grand Prix. Oh, Nicky, by the way, thank you for your stats. They are always amazing. And if you look at the blog that he also has attached to his Twitter page, just fantastic information throughout the weekend as well. It's worth following him to get all that at Lights Out. So if we look ahead to the weekend, then we're quietly confident that A, there may be a drama in Monaco, and B, that Red Bull should be performing well as they consistently have done over the years. Max Verstappen especially, hopefully will have a good race and get it somewhere half decent. Mercedes continue to dominate. What do Ferrari need to do to turn the tide?
A lot, it seems. Yeah. I always find it interesting as well when you get a management change at the level of what's happened with Ferrari. Obviously the main boss has gone, got a new main boss come in. There was a lot of talk at the time that a lot of people in the team wanted this guy to be the team leader. He seems a lot more laid back than the last guy. But it always fascinates me that they make a change in management at that level and everybody expects immediate results. Like, oh, they're going to be brilliant next year because they've changed the boss. And it's like, well, no, it doesn't. You know, sometimes it takes a season or two for that boss's ideas and stuff to come in. Ferrari, for me, just they need to be more on top of this. They've got enough good people. They've got enough people in that team that have been a part of the World Championships, that have won World Championships, that know what they're doing to get that car up where it needs to be. For them to have been slower in Barcelona than they were in pre-season testing is just... Yeah. I can't get my head around that. It's, you know, if you are the big, big boss of Ferrari above the race team, you've got to go, hang on a minute, guys. You know, you've got another 100 million more than any other team. You've got an insane budget. What is going on? You know, why are you not, you know, why are you going backwards? Surely, you know, and if you put a piece on the car and it makes it slower, you surely don't use it in the races then. Like, I can't understand how they're getting it so wrong.
Yeah, this is part of my rant last week about Ferrari. You know, you've got Binotto, who is now the team principal. They left it 13 laps to allow Leclerc to overtake Vettel when Vettel was on the radio begging to come in and change tyres because he'd flat spotted them in the opening lap. So what I want to know is, they've got intelligent people at Ferrari. How come it took 13 laps? Did someone say, we need to pit Vettel or we need to let Leclerc overtake? And is Binotto, the top man, going, no, hang on, and overruling everyone? Or are they all too frightened to make that decision on the strategy desk? I don't know. One interesting point is that James Allison, who was the head strategic guy at Ferrari, is now with Mercedes. Mercedes aren't making any strategic mistakes anymore. Whoever's filled his shoes at Ferrari, I'm just wondering, does he have the freedom to make those calls, or is someone at the top going, hang on, we know what you're saying, we're going to put it to committee, or we're going to wait till Binotto, the boss, has decided? Because you can't be like that in Formula One. You've got to make split-second decisions on the pit wall just like you have as a driver.
Yeah, and if you are Vettel and you're a four-time world champion and you're in the car and you're going, listen, guys, in order for me to go faster, I need to come in and change the tyres, or in order for me to do this, I need to do this. You know, if you're getting that feedback from your driver, how much do you trust them and say, well, listen, we wouldn't have done that as a team, but if you're telling us that you need to come in and change your tyres or whatever, then maybe we need to... You know, we need to do that and trust our drivers.
Yeah, if you listen to Vettel on the radio in Barcelona, he said, I don't care if I come out in traffic, just pit me, was one of the things he said. So obviously he knows they're looking for a window of opportunity. But if you go back over the five races so far this season, in at least three of the races, Vettel has a problem with his starting tyres. In at least three, maybe four races so far this season. You'll hear him post-race, in Baku, post-race, he said, I don't know what happened in the first stint, couldn't switch the tyres on. Obviously, he flat-spotted in Barcelona, but again, first stint ruined because of tyres. Ferrari are obviously, I hope, aware of this like we are, because we're watching the races as well as they are. I don't understand why they don't go, OK, that four-times world champion who we're committed to is telling us he needs to come in for tyres, why they aren't responding quicker. And when it involves his teammate, who is holding up, you know, why aren't they making the switch sooner? It's just, the mind boggles for me, really. And in Monaco, it's all about track position. So they can't afford to leave one of their drivers out with badly performing tyres, holding the other driver up, because it'll just be game over within five laps.
And the problem with tyres as well, if you go back to when we had the two tyre manufacturers and they were kind of fighting it out amongst themselves, you'd get some tracks that were like, oh, this is a Michelin track. Other tracks, they're, you know, this is a Bridgestone track or whatever it was. And you had, you know, that problem of depending on what tyres you were on, you would do better in the race. Now we've got one tyre manufacturer. And like you say, you know, they're producing the same tyre for all the teams. Some teams can turn the tyre on, some teams can't. The Ferrari and the Haas are struggling. But you think, well, what, you know, these are the best engineers in the world. Why can they not get their car to turn the tyres on like the other cars can? I think they need to go back to basics. I think they're trying to be too clever with every part of it. The aero's too clever. Yep. The tyres are too clever. You know, the MGUK systems and the engine systems are too clever. And, you know, we went for when they brought these new engines in, we went for a whole spell of all these engines breaking down every race. And now they've got them bulletproof. Those engines just, you don't see hardly any engine failures anymore. If you do, they're Renault. But you very rarely see it, though. I just feel like they need to kind of go back to basics and go, right, at the end of the day, this is a race car. Yeah, I mean, you look at the cars in the 80s, and I know the times have changed, but those cars were absolute stinkers to drive. Heavy, no power steering, no traction control, tyres bigger than my house, you know, and very basic mechanical cars. The wings on them were just one level, one straight wing. And, you know, they were still race cars, but they were very basic, hard to drive. And, you know, and in those days, you needed to be a strong driver to drive, and you needed big shoulders and big arms. And a lot of the drivers were, you know, borderline overweight because they needed the power and the strength. And you look at it now, all the drivers are like jockeys. They're all like 7-8 stone. Well, maybe not that long, but, you know, 9-10 stone. Depending on how tall they are, there's not an ounce of fat on them. You know, they don't need the power they needed back then because it's all power steering. They've got traction control. The cars have, you know, they can change gear on the steering wheel and everything's mechanical and electronic. And I just feel like we need to go back to basics a bit and make it a bit more, you know, like it was in the old days.
Yeah, I think the debate on that will rage on. I mean, but this is the thing we mentioned on last week's podcast, was that people complain, so they tweak it beyond belief. So people said, if you remember when Pirelli got the tyre brief, they were told, don't make the tyres too easy to drive on. Make the tyres dependent on having the right temperature in them before they'll start working properly. Make the tyres only last for a certain number of laps. This was all done to make the driving of the cars more difficult. But it's all gone full circle now. And then along with that, of course, you've got the better developments in aerodynamics. So the cars are naturally easier to drive. Not that I've ever sat in one and driven it. I probably couldn't. But for those professional drivers, that's why we're getting these processional races. And I hope this weekend in Monaco, we can dispel some of that doom and gloom.
So the Monaco Grand Prix then, fingers crossed, it will be a bit of magic in Monaco this weekend. Hoping for a good one. We're due a good one. I've just got a funny gut feeling it's going to be a good race. I don't know why. I think Verstappen is going to do really well. We've mentioned this before, the Red Bulls. You don't really need the power here around Monaco. So I think the Red Bulls are going to do well. I'm going to go for a curveball and say Verstappen for pole. I'm also going to say Verstappen to win the race. Hamilton second, Bottas third. That's what I'm going for in the race.
You know what? I'm sorry to be boring, that is Formula One at the moment. I agree with you. I also think we may get a surprise from the Renault team this weekend, because it's not a power dominant circuit. I think they might do all right. It's a favourite circuit of Danny Ric. He won here last year, and he's won here a couple of times in the Red Bull. Can he recreate that magic in Monaco?
Follow Two Soft Compounds on Twitter and Facebook. Search for Two Soft Compounds. Two Soft Compounds is a talk about media production. All opinions are our own.